Long-distance relationships can be hard.
The Chinese people stand up for their sovereignty and they expect Australian people and particularly Australian leaders to stand up for theirs.
This week, we look at the very complicated one stretching between Canberra and Beijing. As we record, Foreign Minister Maurice Payne is on her way to the first high-level Australian meeting on Chinese soil in more than 2 years.
China's open door will not close, it will only open wider, and China will not stop taking steps towards building a community with a shared future for mankind.
Payne follows hot on the heels of Trade Minister Simon Birmingham, who witnessed the signing of $15 billion worth of business deals between China and Australia at an import expo in Shanghai this week.
Australia has a good relationship with China, and this week is a very positive week.
So the diplomatic freeze, sparked by Malcolm Turnbull's handling of foreign interference legislation, seems to be warming up. How much this has to do with the Chinese-American trade war is up for discussion.
We see some positive signs in terms of China addressing, I hope, some of the valid concerns the United States has raised over recent times.
Also, the wash-up from the US midterms. We'll check back in with US correspondent Matt Knott at the end of this episode. From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. First, a little note between us, listener. Just after the following two segments were recorded, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg announced he was inclined to knock back a bid by Hong Kong-based CK Group to buy major Australian gas pipeline infrastructure owned by APA. Mr. Frydenberg said the deal would be contrary to the national interest and gave CK Group 2 weeks to appeal. He also said the decision was based on concerns about concentration of foreign ownership of critical infrastructure and was not an adverse judgment on CK itself or on any one country. Nevertheless, the announcement will certainly heighten the atmosphere in Beijing on Thursday when Maurice Payne meets Wang Yi. Keep that in mind as you take in the following discussion. Michael Bachelard is the world editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and David Rowe is our Canberra-based defence and security correspondent. Welcome to Please Explain, Michael and David.
Thanks very much, Tori.
Pleasure.
After this, I'll talk to the CEO of China Matters, Linda Jacobson, about how China is getting on with the rest of the world and if Australian businesses operating in China are feeling the ebbs and flows in our relationship. But first, David, to you. How significant is this visit by our foreign minister, which was only announced on Monday?
It's significant. It's welcome. It's not entirely unsurprising. Sooner or later, China had to end this period of diplomatic frostiness that they have imposed on the relationship. For a number of reasons, Beijing has been annoyed with Australia, and as a consequence, they have essentially put a freeze on a lot of official visits and official interactions for about the past year. The general interpretation of what has happened with this invitation to Maurice Payne, especially in such a busy summit period as Chinese diplomats are getting ready for things like G20 and APEC, is that China has decided that it does actually need the relationship with Australia to be on a better footing than it has been for the past year. Obviously, Donald Trump is having an effect on them and their thinking internationally, and they are starting to look around and say, okay, well, we don't want to have too many bad relationships in too many directions, so it's time to start improving things elsewhere.
It all feels a bit last minute, doesn't it? We found out on Monday night that Maurice Payne had been invited to go to Beijing. She was at the Melbourne Cup on Tuesday, and by Thursday she's in China having this meeting. Has this been a quick turnaround, or have they been working on this for a while, do you think?
I think they've been working on this for a while. I suspect it's just our government not wanting to set the hairs running too early. I think they probably just decided to leave it until fairly shortly before her departure, before actually letting us know. That's my best guess.
It's also delicate, isn't it, Michael? I want to get into a little bit of how we got here. In your view, what was it that was the first point of tension that really saw the Australia-China relationship come into some trouble approximately 18 months ago, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, look, I don't think you can point at any particular inflection point. I think it's something that kind of grew over time. As the Australian government got more interested in looking at the levels of apparent Chinese influence in Australian politics through the donation system with a couple of big donors to both parties, you had a review commissioned by the Turnbull government by an independent guy, John Garno, a former Fairfax China correspondent, who ultimately came out with a pretty critical review of the level of Chinese interference in Australian political life, and also the level of ignorance about it in Australia, and therefore the level of danger that it potentially posed. And so these things kind of coalesced into this, into a series of reports in Fairfax Media, which got a big play in China. The question of foreign influence, and then into legislation that the Turnbull government put into place, which was the foreign interference laws. So those things all sort of were building, and there was a lot of unhappiness in China at Australia, and coincidentally at Fairfax Media, or perhaps not. And then it kind of coalesced late last year when Malcolm Turnbull made a speech, and he quoted Chairman Mao.
Modern China was founded in 1949 with these words, Zhonghua Runmen Zanxi Lai. The Chinese people have stood up. It was an assertion of sovereignty. It was an assertion of pride. And we stand up. And so we say, Adalia Runman Zanxi Lai. The Australian people stand up. There has been foreign interference in Australian politics.
So he appropriated a comment from Mao.
It's quite provocative.
Used it in a way that the Chinese people found extremely provocative. And that's really when the freeze on businesses came to public attention, at least, and became and diplomatic visits as well were ceased. So it really that's when it kind of popped up as a big issue.
David, what's your sense that part of this was about Malcolm Turnbull, and perhaps since he's no longer the Prime Minister, it presented a new opportunity to rebuild the relationship?
I think the way it was put to me, and I think it's probably the best description, is that it gave Beijing a face-saving way to improve a relationship that they felt it was probably time to improve anyway. The Chinese Communist Party, they do care about language. They care about the way things are expressed. They care about the way they are made to look on the international stage. And so expressions like the one that Malcolm Turnbull used, also the fact that foreign interference, and particularly Chinese interference in the Bennelong by-election, and around the time that Sam Dastyari had to resign from Parliament, that put a particular sort of appearance on things that amplified China's displeasure about foreign interference and foreign influence, our laws and our debate around them. They were watching very closely because these are essentially world-leading laws. I don't mean to be partisan about it or anything, but they do sort of go further than a lot of what almost all other countries have gone before.
So what do they actually do, the laws, practically?
One is a new criminal offence for foreign interference. Basically, a lot of activity that previously fell through gaps in previous laws, it's not quite espionage, but it's more serious than just sort of lobbying for a foreign country's interests. So we're talking about surreptitious and covert activity that is meant to undermine Australian national interests that wasn't a criminal offence before is now criminalised. That will capture a large range of activity that wasn't previously captured. Secondly, there's this list of people, agents of foreign influence. This list will force people who are working on behalf of a foreign government to register themselves. It doesn't say that they're doing anything wrong. It just means that the Australian people have a right to know whose interests these people are actually representing. So they're the two, I suppose, the main things. That China was watching those because they were somewhat precedent-setting, and they wanted to be able to sort of say to the rest of the world, this is a problem. Although China wasn't overtly named as the main target of them, it was pretty clear to everyone that it was. I guess around the same time, we were speaking out very strongly on the United States doing freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. We were outspoken in our criticism of China's militarization of artificial islands. There were several other issues that it was just clear to the Chinese at the time that Australia was going to speak out on issues that of Chinese activity, and at least in Beijing's mind, fairly clearly take sides with the Americans on those issues. All of that together, and as Michael was saying, these things coalescing, along with Xi Jinping deciding very categorically that he wanted to impose more control over the Chinese political system and have an expression of that internationally at the same time, I think all of that came together, and that's what sort of got us into that 12-month period of discomfort that we're just apparently coming out of now.
It's interesting timing, Michael, that we apparently are coming out of that period of the deep freeze when really not much has changed. I mean, the points of tension still remain. I mean, we can list them. There is the foreign interference laws. They haven't backed down. Australia has still not committed to signing up to China's big global infrastructure scheme, the Belt and Road. We are still barring Chinese companies, Huawei and ZTE, from taking part in the construction of our 5G mobile network. None of those things have changed. So the only thing that's changed is that Malcolm Turnbull's not the Prime Minister anymore.
Well, that's right. And in addition, just this week, we've given China a bit of a slap on the wrist over how they're acting towards the Uyghurs in the United Nations. So who knows what goes on in the bowels of the Chinese state? But it seems to me that they've put us in the naughty corner. They've delivered a message, but they need us as we need them. They need our imports. They need, they want some of our consumer goods, and they've delivered their message, and now they're perhaps accepting the reality that those policy settings in Australia are not going to change and they're moving on.
Let's talk about the Uyghurs for a second, because our China correspondent Kirsty Needham wrote an amazing piece for last weekend's papers. She actually went to Western China, to the region where they have now locked up more than 1 million Uyghur people, who are the ethnic Muslims based in that part of China, and into these so-called re-education training centres. But people are going in and not coming out again. I believe that Australia has spoken out this week in the UN on this. How provocative is that in the relationship?
Australia was just one of 13 countries to raise the treatment of the Uyghurs, and the United Nations has been quite clear that they think that these, what Chinese call re-education camps, but really are gulags, I think. People go in one province particularly and don't come out, haven't come out for 2 years. They're allowed to make weekly phone calls. It really is like prison. So yes, you're right. A democracy like ours cannot not speak out about things like that in the United Nations. And we have quite correctly done so, saying that there's been a significant regression in China's human rights in that part of China, in the far northwest of China. It's worth noting here how difficult it is to report from there. Kirsty had to take great care to arrive early in the morning, knowing that once she checked into a hotel room that her name would be sent to the police and that she would be detained, and that's precisely what happened. And during that full day of reporting that she got, they got some incredible pictures. We're really able to throw a bit of a light on this real blight on China's international reputation. Australia's in this difficult position, aren't we? We've got a security friend and longtime ally in the United States agitating increasingly against China, particularly through trade. And we've got a growing power in the region, our biggest trading partner, a country that is not a democracy and does abuse human rights, but on whom we depend increasingly economically. And we've got to try and straddle that divide. And we're seeing 12 months in the naughty corner as perhaps a collateral damage from that, the difficulty of doing that.
The fact that we went ahead with this statement in the UN, knowing that it would land just hours before Maurice Payne touches down in Beijing, is laudable, and it shows that, I mean, they must have thought through the timing of that and said we're going to go ahead with it anyway. It will be really interesting to see what Maurice Payne says publicly while she's standing on Chinese soil, and it would be interesting also to see or to hear what she says privately to the Chinese authorities about it. I think we are covered somewhat by the fact that this has really started to get some a lot more international attention in the past, just even the last 3 months, and particularly the last 6 months. The international response had been pretty muted before that, but you're seeing more media reporting of it, and Kirsty's stories, excellent stories, are obviously an example. More governments are speaking out. This, I mean, it really is on a scale that the world cannot look away from anymore. So, it's certainly good that Australia has gone ahead with this, given the timing.
David, on security and military matters, to the untrained eye, it does seem like the heat has come out of the South China Sea situation slightly in the last few months.
It comes and goes. Don't be surprised if next week there's some big news about it again. It really is.
Do you know that, or is that just a general warning that anything could happen?
No, that's a complete guess. If I'm right, I'll pretend that I knew something from deep sources. But look, I mean, it was last month or just at the end of September that the USS Decatur carried out one of these freedom of navigation operations. That's sailing within 12 nautical miles, which is the territorial zone that a piece of sovereign land territory creates, sailing through those through the 12 nautical mile zone of one of these disputed or, well, dubiously claimed artificial islands of China's, that essentially challenges their territorial claim and says we don't buy the fact that this is a piece of your land. they did that, and they were essentially challenged by a Chinese naval ship, and the USS Decatur's captain had to take rather dramatic evasive action to avoid a collision. I think they came something like 40 metres from actually hitting each other, which when you're talking about sort of 8,000 to 9,000 tonnes of ship on either side is pretty damn close. Whether that was just overzealousness by the Chinese ship commander, or whether it signals a tougher response in future from the Chinese, will be a really interesting thing to watch. You'd want to have a spare pair of underpants if you're the next USS ship captain who goes ahead with one of these operations. But, you know, who knows?
Where do we fit in all of this? I mean, are we under pressure to take part in these exercises?
For about 3 years now, the Americans have been quietly pressuring us to do it.
And what is the military leaders here, particularly from the Navy, because they're the ones who'd actually have to do it, do they have a position on it, or do they just defer to the government of the day on it?
They have to defer to the government of the day. It is a government decision. I would say that there is a broadly favourable position within the Australian military to do these sorts of operations. They would be providing all sorts of advice to the government about, here are the strategic benefits of doing it, here are the real risks. The government has not quite found within itself to say yes to this yet, and that's through successive governments. You remember, even Tony Abbott, who was, you know, definitely on the more hawkish side of the recent prime ministers we've had, chose not to go ahead with those. It's a government decision, but I mean, I think if the government gave the green light, the military would be pretty ready to do it.
You find this across the region. I mean, Australia is not directly in dispute with China over these territories, but there are many of our friends and allies in the Southeast Asian region who are, but nobody's really stepping up. And this is what China's Belt and Road Initiative, this massive infrastructure scheme rolling out across the region, more broadly across the world. It helps tie people into a Chinese view of the world. It lends obligations in terms of trade, and particularly trade, but also infrastructure and loans and so on, to not offend China. And so that's why you can see China kind of cleverly using those ties to really really be assertive in the South China Sea and to not have all that much pushback except from the US.
So speaking of Belt and Road, Michael, what did the Victorian government do this week?
It was actually last week or a couple of weeks ago that the Victorian government signed a memorandum of understanding with the Chinese government to sign up to the Belt and Road Initiative. That's been quite contentious because the Australian government federally has decided very clearly not to sign up to the Belt and Road Initiative. It's not ruling out participating in some individual projects, but they have to stack up as projects. And so the Victorian government's gone ahead and kind of gone around the side, I guess, even though under the Constitution, international relations is one of the things that the federal government is responsible for. So that's a really interesting move by Victoria. There's two ways to read it. You could read it as Victoria wanting to get access to Chinese loans to build local infrastructure, and there's a lot of infrastructure on Victoria's plate at the moment, and that very often comes with strings attached from China, including the use of Chinese labour. Politically, that would be absolute the death knell, I suspect, for any government, particularly a Labour government in Australia. So that would be a full bottle rendition of signing up. Or they might be doing what New Zealand has done, which is to sign up but really not engage in any projects. So it's unclear what that achieves other than just kind of getting China off your back. Though it's very open to question as to what the point is if you're simply going to make a show of it without following through.
Michael, David, it's a fascinating time. Thanks so much for your insights.
It's a pleasure, Tori.
Thanks, Tori.
Peter Harcher here, political and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. In an era of fake news and shifting global power, it's critical that your news is genuine and independent. Our reporters in Asia, Europe, and the US work hard to report global stories and how they affect our region. Independent reporting on the ground is crucial to the integrity of our coverage, which we could not do without our subscribers. Support news you can trust and subscribe today.
China is undeniably important to Australia's future. How Australia manages this sometimes tense relationship is crucial to our ongoing wealth and security. Linda Jacobson is the CEO of China Matters, a public policy group navigating the complex waters of Australia-China relations. Hello, Linda.
Good morning.
I've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about Australia's relationship with China and how over the last 18 months to 2 years we've had a bit of a rocky period. How are they going in their relationships with other countries? Are the troubles we've experienced unique to us?
I've studied China for about 30 years, 22 of them of which I lived in the People's Republic of China. And I would say at different times, the PRC always has a rocky relationship with one to two to three countries. So having a tough relationship with China is in no way unique to Australia. If we now look at the last 6 years since Xi Jinping came to power, I think we've seen the Philippines really struggle and the victim of punitive measures by the PRC. We've seen Japan struggle, we've seen South Korea struggle, and Australia has, as you said, had a rocky period for about 18 months.
What do you think drives these ebbs and flows in the relationships? Do you think that the leadership in China is driven by pragmatism and what they believe to be in China's best interests, or is there more to it than that?
What drives the Communist Party leadership is pragmatic approach. We're not talking about ideology here. When a country acts against what China perceives as the national interests of China, China will express its displeasure. If the country in question still does not change either its actions or its views, which it articulates in public, it tends the PRC, not always, but the PRC does tend to then use economic measures to make the country realize that there will be pain in going against the tide, going against what PRC sees as its national interest.
While Chinese investment in Australia has declined over the last 12 months, there's been a huge increase in Chinese investment in Europe. And yet this week, you know, Macron came out and said that Europe should form its own enormous army to sort of guard against future threats from China. That seems quite extreme, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. As a European, I'm a Finn, I should note that at different times in my life, over the last 5.5 decades, Europeans, especially since forming the European Union, have talked about forming an army against some kind of threat. So one has to take this at least with a pinch of salt.
But is China versus Europe sort of the potentially the next theatre that could open up if the US and China sort their relationship out over trade?
I think at the moment, well, first I'll answer the first part of the question. I think China has always been very skillful at finding European countries who want the economic benefits to a degree that they're willing to make compromises on other issues. China has for at least 15 years been extremely skillful in that, and we're just seeing one new cycle of that at this very moment, in my opinion. Generally, I think China is very intent on making sure that it has more friends in the world, especially in the region. At the moment, the thawing of relations between Australia and China is definitely part of that equation. There's a deep sense of concern and anxiety in Beijing at the moment because of the United States' decision to be much tougher towards China. And China is reaching out. We've seen a thaw in the relationship with Japan. We've seen a thaw in the relationship with South Korea, now Australia. And I think there will be real efforts by Beijing to placate some of the concerns that the Europeans have.
And Linda, just finally, Australian businesses that are operating in China or have at least, trade links with China, how have they fared during the recent ebbs and flows in our government relationships? Has it impacted Australian companies' ability to do business there?
There have been some companies who have voiced concerns that they have been targeted. The only one that comes specifically to mind here were problems that some of the wine. But to be honest, direct punitive economic measures have not been that by Australian companies. I think the fear that those economic punitive measures are just about to hit them has been the worst part of this past 18 months. The the sense that we're living in an unpredictable era because the diplomatic relations between the two countries are fraught. Concrete measures are very difficult to identify that China would have taken.
But certainly news this week that Maurice Payne has been invited to Beijing would be welcome to Australian businesses.
Very much so, very much so. Business has been calling from the very start for the government to, yes, take into consideration national security concerns, but at the same time and with equal measure take into consideration that China contributes significantly to Australian standards of living.
Linda, thanks so much for your time and expertise.
Thanks so much.
Linda Jacobson is the CEO of China Matters. Matt Knott, who was on Please Explain last week to discuss the midterms, is our US correspondent. I wish we had an hour to talk election wash-up, but we'll see what we can get through in 10 minutes. Matt, where do we start?
Well, we're now a day after the election and things are starting to settle down. The Democrats are in control of the House, the Republicans are in control of the Senate, and we're in a new political environment. For the past 2 years, the first 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency, it's been one-party rule in Washington, and that's really unusual. Historically, the Republicans have had total control. Now we're in a different world. You've got the Democrats controlling one of the major parts of the government, and this is going to change the dynamics. They're going to be able to launch investigations into the president, into Republican policies. They're going to control key committees, and they're going to be able to draft their own legislation and try and send it up to the Senate and the president to get approved. So we're in a really different environment, and people are talking about the word bipartisanship again.
So he is, of course, describing this as a huge success and a great win for him. But that performance at the press conference indicated that he's not feeling quite so secure, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. His scripted remarks were very much about what an amazing victory this was, but his demeanour was telling a bit of a different story.
And ran a fantastic race. On the other hand, you had some that decided to, let's stay away. They did very poorly. I'm not sure that I should be happy or sad, but I feel just fine about it. Mia Love gave me no love, and she lost. Too bad. Sorry about that, Mia. And Barbara Comstock was another one. I mean, I think she could have won that race, but she didn't want to have any embrace. For that, I don't blame her. But she lost, substantially lost. Peter Roskam didn't want the embrace. Eric Paulson didn't want the embrace. And in New Jersey, I think he could have done well, but didn't work out too good. Those are some of the people that, you know, decided for their own reason not to embrace whether it's me or what we stand for.
The result that we saw was not as big as the most optimistic Democrats would have hoped. There were some really high-profile races that they didn't win, but it was definitely a victory for them in terms of the House. The popular vote, they won by about 7%. Now, that's historically as high, if not higher, than the swing towards the opposition party in a president's first term. It's a big result. They've been picking up seats all over the country, including places you wouldn't expect them to win, like Kansas and Oklahoma.
How much danger is Donald Trump in now of all of his private affairs being investigated by House committees?
He is in a lot of danger, but there is a tactical dilemma perhaps for the Democrats. Perhaps the advantage for Donald Trump is that he does now have an opposition to run against. Before, he had total control, so he could only be at war with his own party, really. So if the Democrats do become very aggressive in terms of going after Trump, then he will use that as evidence that they're not really interested in policy. They're not really interested in doing things for ordinary people. They're only interested in resisting and obstructing. So I think they have a fine line to walk between providing accountability and transparency and a check and a balance on the president while also showing that they're trying to do practical things for the voters who they're going to want to win over in 2 years at the presidential election.
So one of the first things that Donald Trump has done post-election is sack his attorney general. What's going on there?
Now, it's been clear for a long time, since last year, that Trump is very unhappy with his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, because of the fact he recused himself from any involvement in looking at Russia's involvement in the 2016 election. Now, it's been well reported that the Robert Mueller inquiry is coming to an end. He wouldn't release the results before the midterm elections, but we're expecting to see more coming out about that before the end of the year. And then today, Trump fires his attorney general. He's put in place an acting attorney general who has said some very interesting things about the Russia inquiry, has said that, for example, you could starve it of funding. Maybe you wouldn't sack Robert Mueller, but you could essentially bleed it to death, and has said other things about the fact that it shouldn't be going into his family. There are reports today that Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., thinks he's going to be indicted as part of the inquiry, the investigation, and Trump is very protective of his family members. So this is massive and a really strange move to put this back into the spotlight again. But in some ways, I think Trump feels quite emboldened by the Senate victory, and he's wanted to get rid of Sessions for a long time, and he's going to do it, and no one in the party is going to stop him.
Is there going to be much change because of the House going to the Democrats now over some of Donald Trump's bigger sort of foreign policies? Are they going to be able to stop him, for instance, raising tariffs on China, or are they going to be able to do anything about what he's up to on the Mexican border?
Some Democrats would be quite open to the idea of trying to keep car manufacturing jobs in America. Traditionally, it would be Republicans, the small government free market party that would be opposed to it. So the president so far has been doing all that, his tariffs with executive orders. He hasn't needed Congress to approve it. There might be some pushback there from the Democrats. Immigration is a big one. It's not popular among the Democratic base to give funding for a wall, but you would think, even hope, that perhaps there could be some kind of bipartisan deal could be done to give amnesty to some of the millions of undocumented immigrants who came to America as children in many cases. It wasn't their choice, and they are being deported, that there could be some kind of bipartisan deal reached in which you give those people protections and give something for Trump on the border, perhaps even something that he can call a wall.
Mm. And how long do we get before they start campaigning on the 2020 presidential election?
About tomorrow, I think. Once the midterms are over, it's all going to be going forward to 2020. And the interesting thing is that it's so unclear who the Democratic nominee is going to be. There are so many people who would want to do it, and many different strategies and ideas about how to go about it. I don't think that the party is that much wiser from the midterms about how to deal with someone so unusual and unorthodox as Trump. I was thinking two examples that we saw coming out of it was we saw Beto O'Rourke in Texas, who ran this very, very strongly a progressive campaign, much more far out on the left than you would expect someone in Texas to run, even as a Democrat, and came very close to defeating Ted Cruz there in what is a strongly Republican state. So that's one kind of model about really creating an electricity amongst left-wing voters. Then you see other models out there in the Midwest, some of the senators who are taking more of a focus on pragmatic issues, working class issues, a more conciliatory tone, contrasting with Trump's rhetoric, adopting more of a conciliatory tone, reaching out to the white working class. So this is going to start. There's going to be a long, long list of different candidates battling it out to compete against Trump, and it's very unclear who it's going to be.
Well, Matt, we're getting an overwhelmingly positive response to all of your brilliant coverage of this election, particularly your Travels in Trumpland features. So great job and interesting times.
It's been a lot of fun.
US correspondent Matt Knott from New York. Thanks to our guests this week, Michael Batchelard, David Rowe, Linda Jacobson and Matthew Knott. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Support the work we do. Our subscribers get unlimited access to award-winning, independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to subscribe today. This episode was produced by David Escort and Nicole Presell. Technical assistance from David McMillan and Cormac Lally, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.
China has total respect for Donald Trump and for Donald Trump's very, very large brain.